This is The Campaign Trail, Tuesday, November 13th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Each week on The Campaign Trail, we discuss the presidential race and developments in Washington.
And this is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, April 28th, and I'm still Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Back in 2007, as the primary race between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton for the Democratic presidential nomination was heating up, I was asked by the editor of The New Yorker's fledgling website if I'd host something called a podcast, just for a few months, about the extraordinary campaign. My first episode as the host of The New Yorker's politics podcast aired that November, and this episode, 15 years later, is my last. But though this is my last show, the political scene is going to continue on. More on that at the end of this episode. My time as host has coincided with one of the most tumultuous political eras in American history. The tumult is being driven by a question whose answer will determine our future. What kind of country do we live in? A buffeted but resilient liberal democracy? Or a nation increasingly known among its own citizens for its divisions rather than for its shared commitment to tolerance, equality, and freedom? A country that is maybe creeping toward autocratic oligarchy. Today, I want to talk to three of our regular guests about that question. We'll start with Evan Osnos, a New Yorker staff writer, who joins me from a reporting trip to Italy. Hey, Evan.
Hi, Dorothy.
We've been talking for years about this crisis in American liberalism. You started covering U.S. politics for The New Yorker in 2013 after 5 years of reporting for us from China. And since then, you've written about the trajectory from Obama to Trump to the Biden presidencies, and more broadly about the rise of authoritarianism around the world. I wanted to ask you what attracted your attention as you looked into the state of American democracy.
I think, Dorothy, that I was really startled, frankly, when I came back to the U.S. This was a few years before Donald Trump really dominated our politics, but you already saw these really clear indications of ways that we'd been losing ground on democracy. I mean, the things that sustain and fortify democracy, like the right to vote in clearest terms. I mean, the power of fact that was already really under attack, in a sense, online. And then you had this broader sense of, in a democracy, you have the freedom from fear of violence, I think, by your fellow citizens or by the state. And I think there was this sense at the time that all of those things were in some kind of recession. I mean, I was writing about the ways that people were talking about Muslims and immigrants. And there was one statistic, I think, that really stayed with me. And it was in 2016, there were some researchers who went out and asked Americans to estimate the share of Muslims in the American population. And Americans answered that they thought it was 1 in 6. And the real number was 1 in 100. And so there was a way in which I think some of those distortions in our perceptions of ourselves were becoming really important in understanding the politics that followed.
And tell me if I'm wrong, but I recall we had originally thought you'd be working on a piece about Donald Trump, and then you'd started doing some of your reporting, and you kept coming across these white supremacists, and you decided actually the piece was going to be one and the same. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was a strange moment, because I'd been working on a story that was inspired by the massacre at a church in South Carolina. People will remember that a white supremacist went in and killed black parishioners as they were praying. And so I was working on a story about what was that world that he inhabited online and in the world. And then we said, I'm going to take some time out actually to go do a completely different story, which was about this candidacy of Donald Trump. And after I'd been working on that for just a few days, it was so clear that they were actually the same story. I remember calling you actually, Dorothy, and saying, this is odd, but this actually needs to be one piece. And that's what we ended up doing. And that was the first story that I did on this phenomenon that ended up becoming a long-running feature of our coverage.
And I believe it was one of the first pieces that really explicitly made that connection. You have been interested in Joe Biden long before he was elected president. And I think it's fair to say you've studied his career and his presidency so far, at least as much as anyone has. So we're now a third of the way through his term, and the 2022 midterms are underway. What do you think the most important measures of the Biden presidency are so far?
Yeah, we're at a point now where I suppose we can do something of a balance sheet. I mean, look, to be blunt about it, Dorothy, it's a pretty excruciating moment to be president of the United States. We sort of knew that going in all of the ways that this country was already polarized, already divided. I think in the early months of the administration, there were some things that were encouraging, like they were able to pass this COVID stimulus bill without any Republican votes. It's worth reminding ourselves it was really just Democrats who did it. And then eventually there was this bipartisan infrastructure bill. But since then, the momentum has shifted. And I think that the pullout from Afghanistan, which was so chaotic and I think damaging to our image of how we imagine ourselves in the world as capable of doing something like that with grace and competence, that was the beginning of when his reputation began to slide in the eyes of Americans, and his popularity has been falling since then. But at the core of the problem politically for Joe Biden or many other people who could be in that job is that right now the Democratic Party is this vast enterprise that spans all the way from Joe Manchin, obviously, on the conservative end, to AOC at its most progressive end. And in any other political system, that would not be a single party. I mean, there's the eccentricity of the American political system that requires people to organize themselves into just two parties is part of the reason why you then end up with parties that are almost incapable of agreeing with themselves internally. I think more broadly speaking, in the world, the U.S. is now in the grip of this very explicit competition, really, with authoritarianism around the world. You have Vladimir Putin seizing territory in ways that have not happened in Europe since World War II. And then he is putting himself in league with another strongman, and that, of course, is Xi Jinping in Beijing. They are very different. I mean, the two systems have a lot that separates them, probably more than unites them. But it is a clarifying moment for the stakes for the United States and the stakes for democracy, because we started the Biden presidency saying democracy is imperiled inside the United States. And here we are now looking at it around the world and saying, actually, the project for democracy is even larger. And I think that has been a bit of an organizing principle for Biden as he goes about what's closing in on the second half of his term.
Thanks, Evan.
Thanks, Dorothy.
Susan Glasser, a New Yorker staff writer, writes the Letter from Biden's Washington column for NewYorker.com. Over the course of her career, she's reported from Russia, Iraq, and Afghanistan, and written extensively about American foreign and domestic policy. Hey, Susan. Thanks for coming on.
Hey there. Thanks, Dorothy.
In 2020, you co-authored a book about James Baker, who served in top positions under Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, including as Secretary of State under Bush. Baker, as I've learned from you and others, was an architect of much of America's foreign policy at the end of the Cold War and beyond. Could you just tell us a little bit about that, which I think will help orient us to the position we're in right now?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. This moment, you could say, is the unraveling of the era that Jim Baker and George H.W. Bush really made, this post-Cold War era of an American-led international order. There was a great sense in Washington and other world capitals that, you know, we had sort of dodged a bullet, right? That the Soviet Union had collapsed more or less peacefully. And here was this new, even post-historical age of American-led economic globalization, an unprecedentedly peaceful era. And, you know, that this would really be a different moment. And of course, what we're seeing now is sort of the final three decades later, a collapse of of that optimism.
And the U.S. has always defined itself as a global champion of liberal democracy. But now, as you point out, our foreign policy is in the hands of a deeply divided, catastrophically partisan federal government. How has that affected the view of the country from abroad?
Yeah, I mean, look, the image of America in the world has taken a series of successive batterings. First of all, there was the incredible swing from global support for the United States in the immediate aftermath of the September 11th attacks and, you know, a real rallying around the flag, including, I would note, in Moscow and other capitals. And then the pendulum swung very dramatically. A lot of opposition in the world to George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq and the subsequent global war on terror, as his aides framed it. And, you know, then Barack Obama came in, incredibly popular, especially in Western Europe and with our allies there. Donald Trump not only was unpopular in much of the world, he was historically unpopular. And so, you know, there's just basically a sense, though, even among those who might be welcoming the return of a more normal administration here in the United States, a real sense that this is kind of the end of American hegemony, the end of American global leadership, that America is now engaged in an inward-looking battle with itself over what kind of country we're going to be going forward.
In 2005, you and your co-author, Peter Baker, published a book about Vladimir Putin, who was then in his first term as president. Now, of course, his role in global politics has grown dramatically. What did Trump and other budding autocrats learn from Putin politically, and how are we seeing his influence play out now in Europe?
Yeah, it's so remarkable. Peter and I were there as correspondents in Moscow for basically the first few years of Putin's ascendancy. And, you know, what we saw was a very ambitious project to undo what he saw as the catastrophic unraveling of the Soviet Union. And, you know, we saw phase one, which was to restore power inside of Russia itself. You know, that was remarkably successful. Purging of independent media, purging of independent business people and centers of power. You know, step two has been this just remarkable and very ominous reemergence of Russia as a global actor. And Putin very, very consciously sees himself as kind of, you know, dunking on the ashes of liberal democracy. And this has come at the same moment in time. There's been a rise of what you might call the democratic nationalist authoritarians, small d democratic, people like Viktor Orban in Hungary, and like Donald Trump here in the United States. So it's not just the autocracies versus the democracies. That's what you hear from Joe Biden a lot. That's his framing. But it, even within the democracies, there's essentially a pro-Putin faction. And that's really something I think we wouldn't have guessed in the days when Jim Baker was negotiating a peaceful end to the Cold War.
So we see that phenomenon playing out. But we also are seeing Ukraine with this strong, united backing from Western democracies mounting a fierce resistance to Putin's invasion. And President Zelensky is widely viewed as a leader who both embodies and articulates the idea of the free world. Does this message that he's projecting have any effect that you're seeing against the powers of people like Viktor Orban?
You know, Dorothy, first of all, President Zelensky is an amazing reminder that, you know, to have humility, we journalists and pundits, because you know what? 2 months ago, I think today is when this war started. And a month or so before that, Vladimir Zelensky was extraordinarily unpopular. He was considered to be essentially a failed leader. And it's a reminder, first of all, that, you know, when there's an existential threat in politics, a lot of the performative garbage that, you know, passes for politics, like in Western capitals today, disappears. But part of it is that he's emerged, I think, as a uniquely suited wartime leader and wartime communicator for his people. And you know, President Zelensky and President Biden, I think, have something in common right now, which is a need for people to believe that this is a clarifying moral crusade, a moment of choice between democracy and autocracy, notwithstanding the fact that, unfortunately, many of these democracies are sharply, sharply divided on the inside.
And what about the Republican Party? There is strong support at the moment for the war, for giving lots of money to Ukraine and weapons. And that, of course, is the position of the Democratic Party. Do you see any more coming together, you know, across partisan lines? Or is this just going to be a one-time thing? And then when they go out to campaign, it's going to be more Trumpist rhetoric?
Short answer, yes. there's no indication whatsoever that this is more than kind of skin deep unity. I think there is a broad convergence, as you said, in Congress, certainly, to support the Ukrainians. However, there's no indication. Republicans' view, as best I can understand it right now, is never mind the fact that we're completely captured and, in fact, remain a subsidiary of a pro-Putin president, Donald Trump. We're so pro-Ukrainian that we want to give him more, but actually it's Joe Biden's fault that he hasn't done enough for them. It's almost an unsustainably confusing position, but I don't see any indication. They'll simply blame Biden for anything that happens. And, you know, again, he is the president right now, so you know, it's his leadership that's at stake. But the pro-Putin wing of the Republican Party, it's not a majority of the Republican Party, but it is a significant chunk of the Republican Party. And I don't see any indication of that going away.
Thanks so much, Susan. I know you're on a very tight deadline for your next book about Trump, so I will let you go.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Jane Mayer is The New Yorker's chief Washington correspondent and the author of Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. Jane, thanks as ever for joining me and here in New York, a rare treat.
So great to be here and in New York.
We have been hearing a lot lately about the oligarchs who shore up Vladimir Putin's power in Russia and abroad. But you've been writing for years about billionaires who exert a tremendous and often unseen influence on politics here in the United States. Is there any reason not to call them American oligarchs?
I think there's less and less reason not to call them American oligarchs. I mean, everybody hesitated for a while, but I think there's really nothing else you can call them at this point. And the worry is, do we live not in a democracy, but in an oligarchy?
Yeah, exactly. So who are these people, and how have they influenced and undermined our democratic institutions?
Well, I mean, really what's happened is since the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court in 2010, the parties have grown weaker and outside funders have grown much more powerful. People with huge amounts of money who have extreme views and really want to influence American politics. And they are on the left and the right, but particularly on the right, I think they've had more influence. And so right now, one of the people who you can see is lined up to spend a tremendous amount of money, has already started spending a ton of money, is Peter Thiel, you know, the Silicon Valley libertarian, and he's throwing his money behind two conservative Senate candidates, one in Arizona and one in Ohio. And, you know, it raises the question, is this country for sale? You know, and is that how we want to elect people?
And also, you know, it just this has become this self-perpetuating kind of corruption machine, and also worsening the divide between the very, very rich and the very poor.
Well, that's such a good point. I mean, and that is the concern, is that what you're going to see and what we have seen is the empowerment of a handful of the wealthiest people in the country who then capture the Congress and other parts of the government and turn it into something that is servicing their own interests, not the public interests. And we start seeing this kind of growing inequality economically, that to the point where now it is equal to what we saw before the progressive era in the United States, when, you know, the Gilded Age, and maybe even greater.
And part of the effect is spreading cynicism about politics.
I mean, and that's where, and that is also what's dangerous, is not only does the government get captured, but then much of the population loses its faith in the honesty of the government and its trust in the institutions. And so you begin to see this erosion and the spread of cynicism. And that then opens up a lot of people to saying things like elections are rigged. And it makes people, you know, voters susceptible to maybe wanting to bring in a strong man who will fix this for them.
Last week, you wrote about the American Accountability Foundation, which has funded particularly scurrilous campaigns against Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson and others. Tell us a little bit about that group.
Well, it's a group that pretends to be a charity. You can give to it and get a tax deduction, but what it really is doing is spewing out disinformation. Its aim is to try to stop every one of the Biden administration's nominees to important jobs that require Senate confirmation. As an end in itself, not because any particular nominee is a problem, but they want to try to just trip him up in every way so that he can't deliver on his campaign promises and his agenda. And so they've just been throwing mud at so many of these people. And interestingly, a disproportionate number of them that they've gone after are women. 60% of their targets are women, that at least according to our count, and 30% were people of color. So Ketanji Brown Jackson was right up their alley, and they were the ones that at least they take credit for trying to frame her as soft on child pornographers and pederasts, none of which was true, all of which was just a hideous distortion of her record. It's a lie. It's a little factory for alternative facts, which other people sometimes call lies.
Americans, at least until recently, have always boasted about how robust our democracy is and how other countries have strived for the ideals this country purportedly represents. But we're seeing, and in some of the ways you're describing, a steady erosion of democratic norms. The system, our system, is supposed to defend against these kinds of corrosive influences. So where are the guardrails? Do you have hope that this kind of thing can be arrested?
I mean, I'm always somehow optimistic. I mean, if you want to look on the bright side, the courts held, and they held up against the fake election challenges that Trump and his allies brought. Civil society's held up quite well. The press has done a fantastic job, I think. You know, there are some bright spots here. But, I mean, it's, you know, you'd be foolish not to say that it's worrisome. And, you know, when I listen to people like Rick Hazen, who's the election law expert, who he is warning, and he warned in a piece that we did, that election subversion is actually the fear that he's got, not just suppressing voters, but subverting the outcome of an election. And he's called attention to basically three ways that that could happen. One is that the state legislatures might interfere and overthrow an election. The second thing that he's warned against is that many of the people who are running for positions in election administration in the country are currently saying that they believe that Trump won the last election, and they may not be trustworthy or reliable in terms of telling the truth about who really won in an election. And the third thing he worries about is actually violence, because there have been so many threats to people who are involved in election administration. And there's kind of a growing anger on the whole subject. So, I mean, it's, you know, incredibly worrisome. But I have to believe that just writing about it, talking about it, and making people aware of it will get people to spring into action and defend our democracy.
Thanks so much, Jane.
Great to be with you.
And I'm back with Evan Osnos.
Hi, Dorothy.
Evan, my conversations with Susan and with Jane weren't exactly drenched in optimism. That's often the case around our offices. And when I'm feeling gloomy about current events, I often call you to talk about what can be done to repair the broken machinery. And at the risk of being called a Pollyanna, I've also periodically asked you and others to project, you know, some pragmatic hopes about how the future might unfold. And you've got two young kids. What do you hope for them?
Yeah, I have to say it has been a period when it's hard to find those moments of optimism. However, they are there. I think part of it is this experience of having lived overseas for a long time and coming back. I tend to look at what's happening in our country in relation to things that I've seen in other places. And I'm very struck these days by the power of self-correction as an ingredient in politics in our country and in other countries, and the degree to which you're able to steer the ship of state when it's careening towards disaster in the end is the defining distinction of a country that is able to fix itself. And I've lived in these countries that are authoritarian states. And you know, if you go back in Chinese history, you don't have to go very far to discover moments when the lack of any kind of political tolerance, the lack of any political debate drove the society into disaster. And in this country, we have come so close in the last few years, just, I mean, extraordinarily, to really doing permanent damage to democracy. And at the same time, almost despite ourselves, we're able to steer ourselves away. There is this pendulum quality in American politics. It's almost an unannounced kind of self-corrective mechanism that when we get too far in one direction, that things begin to pull themselves back. And, you know, that can be a little bit of cold comfort if you're saying, well, we're sort of relying on this hidden momentum in our politics to help us, except that that actually, I think, is the deeper strength, is that we have the ability to throw the bums out every 4 years, every 2 years. We're able to do that and to start again. And that is something that remains a fundamental strength of ours.
For most of my time hosting this show, you've been one of our regular guests. I think your first appearance on the political scene was on July 30th, 2009. Hmm. And you were calling in from Beijing, where you were based at the time. Obama was president, and we were discussing the strategic and economic dialogue between China and the U.S., though I had to point out that the subject was being overshadowed here by the beer summit. Do you remember the beer summit?
I do. I think probably more Americans remember that than they do the strategic and economic dialogue of China. I think probably everybody at the beer summit has more white hair today than they did back then. But I also wonder, Dorothy, if I can turn the tables on you for a moment, because I wanted to ask you about hosting this show for so long. You've hosted hundreds of these episodes of The Political Scene, and I've wondered what moments stand out for you most vividly.
Well, yeah, talk about white hairs. So I have to say that I like to think way back in the early years of the podcast when it was just, you know, a little tiny operation when podcasts were barely, you know, a thing yet. And so it was a very informal conversation, mostly with one of my oldest friends and colleagues, Hendrik Hertzberg. And he and I went all the way back to my really my origins as a journalist at the New Republic. And so I knew his politics very well, and he knew a great deal about me. And I have to say that Rick really influenced me over the years. He's kind of an old lefty. And so, and he also presciently pointed out that our system of democracy was broken. And it was a time when people thought that was kind of an oddball idea. You know, he would talk about parliamentary democracy, and he would talk about some of the flaws in the Constitution. And I loved thinking about those things, not never anticipating that we would be where we are now.
You mentioned that you were at the New Republic, and, you know, that is, in some ways, was the cradle of political writing for a lot of people, Rick Hertzberg among them. I'm curious, Dorothy, though, what drew you to political writing and thinking in the first place?
It was my years at the New Republic. It was my second job as a journalist. My first job went right out of college, was at the Shakespeare Quarterly, where I was at the Folger Shakespeare Library, and the staff would have tea every afternoon with the readers at the library. It was a very, very different environment. And I loved my colleagues there, and I loved going down into the stacks and looking at the first folios of Shakespeare. That was kind of incredible. But it was way too slow and sleepy for me. So after a year or two, I applied to a job at the New Republic, and it was a very small staff, but it was being run then by Michael Kinsley, who was all of maybe 26 years old, you know, one of the most brilliant journalists I've ever met, still a friend. But I knew very little about politics at the time. But there I was with all of these, it has to be said, mostly white men, meeting every week in a conference room to talk about the politics of the time and what we wanted to say in the magazine about it. So I was there for 15 years. And so I was just steeped in American liberalism and in really contentious debates about the extent to which America should intervene abroad. What was wrong with the Democratic Party? Those were the days leading into the Bill Clinton era when Democrats, liberal Democrats, thought, "Oh, we've gone too far to the left, so we have to have one of those moments of self-correction and move toward the middle." So, and thus, the New Republic played a pretty big role in the birth of neoliberalism, which today has many justifiable critics, but also some supporters still.
Yeah, you described this arc of thinking about the possibilities of politics. There was a time, actually, when a political conversation every week in the office could be about what's possible and what could be done. Was there a moment when you began to feel that shift to something more dire?
Sometime late in my time at the New Republic, I was asked to put together an anthology of the New Republic on its 70th anniversary. And I wrote the introduction to that, and I hadn't looked back at it for decades. And the other day, I just picked it up thinking, you know, that we were going to be talking a little bit about the history of liberalism. And I had to laugh because my opening sentence of the introduction was something like, 20th century American liberalism has won. And I thought, oh, my God. But then leafing through it, I realized that I also was acknowledging some of the pendulum swings that you mentioned earlier. And so it is, we have to remember that one of the defining characteristics of a democracy is this constant battle. What does this experiment in democracy mean? And this was a democracy, after all, that was born in revolution. And so we are now in a period that perhaps is as close to the 1850s in the years leading up to the Civil War as we've ever been. And that is deeply worrisome. On the other hand, as you also mentioned, there are the countervailing forces. And after all, Joe Biden was elected president after Donald Trump by recalling to Americans what our core values are. So again, when we're looking for hope, we have to kind of think about that as well, and also think about what it means to be an active responsible citizen in a democracy. And we have all been, I think, complacent for too long because we've had a long period of prosperity for many people. And we began to notice, and we noticed this at the New Republic, that there was a problem called income inequality, but we didn't take it seriously enough. So belatedly, same thing with climate change. Al Gore was a bit, we wrote a lot and very positively about Al Gore. But remember when he started talking about climate change, people, you know, laughed at him.
Yeah. Yeah, I think your point about the power of history and the ability to know what we've been through seems to loom larger and larger. I should say, you know, many listeners will know this, but some people won't, that along with putting out the New Yorker every week, you've somehow been also able to get your own writing done. I sometimes picture you, Dorothy, between, you know, maybe midnight and 2 a.m. writing your books. But your first book, Nothing Daunted, came out in 2011. And last year you published The Agitators. So can we expect to see more writing from you on the horizon? Is that what you're planning to do now that you're not going to be distracted by editing and podcasting every week?
Yes, thank you for asking. And I insist on telling people who say, so you're retiring. And I say, no, I'm not retiring. I'm just changing jobs. And not only that, I'm actually staying at The New Yorker, and I want to continue writing for The New Yorker, my favorite magazine, and my favorite colleagues. I can't say goodbye. So that book took me 7 years to write because I did have a full-time job. But it was about these three amazing women who lived in the same town and were abolitionists and women's rights advocates in the years leading up to the Civil War. One was a fugitive slave known as Harriet Tubman, and the other two women, one was a middle-class Quaker, and the other was an aristocrat. And they would have seemed to have had so little in common, but actually they had everything in common based on their ideas about American democracy and about the principles of the Declaration of Independence, which, after all, they were very close to that era. Our country's history is so short and is so filled with animus and racial hatred and misogyny. And I knew this, of course, but as I was writing this book, I just felt it over and over again that we are reliving these original weaknesses, fundamental weaknesses. But what gave me hope is that sometimes at moments of crisis, through the combination of grassroots, really intensive grassroots organizing, and responsible politicians in the White House and in Congress, we can right the ship of state.
Yeah.
And it neither one nor the other can do it alone, but these women working with men and women who shared their beliefs, they managed to overturn slavery and they managed to secure some fundamental rights for women. So doing that book has made me, I'm really interested in American history and politics, mm-hmm. obviously, but I'm also really concerned about what's going on right now. So I hope what I'll be writing about is some of the issues that we're all facing and fight back. You know, as journalists, we fight back through our writing and by going out and talking to people and listening to people whose voices often aren't heard. So these are some, and it's complicated and difficult, but it's one of the things The New Republic does, and The New Yorker does, and so I hope to just do it from a different seat.
By the way, Dorothy, I can just tell you, I mean, just hearing in your voice, there you have such a clear sense of what it is that you want to take on now. I think that's pretty thrilling, actually, as a writer.
Oh,
I mean,
thank
to,
you.
You know, you're right. You're just about to plunge into it. That's a really wonderful moment, you know.
Yeah, it is. Out of the frying pan into the fire, but I'll do my best. And you haven't heard the last of me. I'll be calling you all the time for your advice.
I hope so. So let's talk about the future of the show.
Yes, I'm really happy to report that though this is my last show as host, The Political Scene will be continuing. And in fact, Evan, you'll be hosting next week.
I will. And over the next couple of weeks, our listeners can expect to hear from a lot of their favorite political thinkers and writers from The New Yorker, a lot of familiar voices. So, the political scene is not going anywhere. Politics continues to be mercilessly complicated, and we're going to be here to try to help people make some sense of it and help ourselves, I suppose, make some sense of it.
I will be listening avidly. And I'd like to give special thanks to Alex Barron and Kylie Warner, the brilliant, overworked producers of this program, and to our loyal listeners around the world. I'll really miss you all. And Evan, will you have me back on one day as a guest?
That is a promise. You have a lifetime pass.
Thank you. Evan Osnos is a New Yorker staff writer and the author of Joe Biden, The Life, The Run, and What Matters Now, and Wildland, The Making of America's Fury. Susan Glasser is a New Yorker staff writer and the author of several books, including Kremlin Rising, Vladimir Putin's Russia, and The End of the Revolution, and The Man Who Ran Washington, The Life and Times of James A. Baker III. Jane Mayer is the New Yorker's chief Washington correspondent and the author of several books, including, most recently, Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. And I, Dorothy Wickenden, am the author of The Agitators. You can find more of my writing and more to come on NewYorker.com. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.